Hello, and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast. I'm Sam Wannavy, a second-year PhD candidate here at the University of Cambridge. Today we're joined by Jefferson Cowie, James G. Stallman Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. Professor Cowie is the author of many widely acclaimed books, including 2016's The Great Exception, The New Deal and the Limits of American Politics. Today we're here to discuss his latest book, Freedom's Dominion, A Saga of White Resistance to Federal Power, winner of the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for History. I'm also joined by Rob O'Sullivan, a fourth-year PhD student here at Cambridge, who works on Irish-American views on slavery and nationalism in the 19th century United States. Okay, thank you for joining us, Professor Cowie. We're gonna start off with just an introductory question of, how did you come to this project? What is it about Barbour County in particular that attracted you?
Two very different questions. We'll get to Barbour County in a second, but I had been interested in a couple of themes in American history. One was sort of the anti-statist impulse that ran pretty deep in American history and politics. So I've always been wondering about that. And I had some enduring thoughts about or questions about freedom, because it became very evident to me at an early age, a long time ago, that what I thought of as freedom wasn't what everybody else thought of as freedom all the time. So parsing out the nature of freedom seemed to go hand in hand with that anti-statist impulse. So those are kind of, that's kind of the background of how I was thinking about it, sort of vague questions. And then from a writerly perspective, I sort of wanted to find a way to explore that in a kind of rich way. And so I didn't want to do a national narrative, because I thought that was a little too easy, because you can cherry pick stuff and choose your quotes or whatever. So I was looking for a place or a thing or a person or something to explore this idea. And I accidentally stumbled upon Barbour County, Alabama, which is in the southeast corner of Alabama. And we were just driving through town by accident, and my spider senses went off, and I said, I think this is the place. And then 6 months later, I found out George Wallace was from the county. And then I decided it's not just the right place, it's fate. So that's, and then the story just revealed itself in this really interesting way.
Definitely. So the study is a close analysis of those conflicting, as you say, kinetic energies of the compound republic as they unfold in one place over time. So going off of that, how did you go about extrapolating the history of the nation from the history of one county? And then more broadly, do you have any advice for any historian attempting similar kinds of microhistory to macro history?
Well, I'm flattered you think I got the whole history of the country in one county. Certainly, I was trying to get insights on the history of the entire nation from one county. And, you know, it was kind of amazing how well it opened up. And I kept kind of going back on, like, how much sort of bias is going into this, and I have to double check to make sure that I was actually on course, and then I go back and yeah, there's this story just keeps popping up over and over and over again. So once you dig into a single place, I think it has a way of revealing some pretty exciting possibilities. And what I was doing was thinking a little bit about the old social history of the 70s and the 1980s and maybe a little of the 90s, where, you know, people were doing these intense analyses of places, but they were kind of disembodied in a way. So I kind of took that idea, added a little bit of linguistic turn with the idea of freedom and a little bit of kind of the new social history of politics and maybe a little bit of history of capitalism, and put them all in the stew and sort of livened them up. And if anybody is going to do this kind of approach, I think you have to bring big questions to small places. You can't just, small places, I don't think, I mean, unless you're there and inherently interested in a sort of antiquarian way, small places don't really hold the attention of a national audience, or in this case, international, as much as the big ideas do. So you have to really bring the question of a big idea to a small place. And I think that was kind of lost in a certain way. We lost connection to the local, and we went to big ideas, and now I'm trying to sort of bring the big ideas to the local.
Thank you. In the interest of our listeners who maybe haven't had a chance yet to pick your book up, can you please give our listeners an overview of the book's central arguments?
There's people who haven't read it yet?
One or two.
Okay.
Not in this room, obviously.
So the Compound Republic, as we already heard, is central to the idea. So there's a few ideas you have to begin with before you can understand why this one obscure, tiny, backwoods county matters. And the first idea is kind of the idea of the Compound Republic. That, and you know, Gary Gersel's done a lot of work on this, of course, with Liberty and Coercion, that what we tend to call federalism means a kind of, not just a sort of series of safeguards as it was intended, but a series of conflicts between the local, the state, and the federal. And this is an ongoing struggle, and of course went completely haywire in the Civil War. So that's kind of thing one. Thing two is understanding freedom as kind of a complicated thing, not a thing we can take apart, understand historically, and sort of pull into different dimensions. And here I rely on this guy, Orlando Patterson, a sociologist at Harvard, who breaks freedom down into kind of civic freedoms, political or individual freedoms, and then this sort of freedom to control or freedom to dominate, which he calls sovereignal or sovereignal freedom. And that's that third one that I was really interested in. So then you take those two elements, the Compound Republic, and then this idea of freedom to dominate, and you stick it in the American South, which is a chattel slave, a settler colonial region, and those ideas really kind of become magnified in significant ways. And so those three elements I take forth through four major periods, Indian removal, Civil War / Reconstruction, the post-Civil War era, the Gilded Age, and into the early 20th century, which is a period I call federal power in repose. This is what happens when the federal power is not present. And then the modern civil rights period. And in each case, because of the Compound Republic, we see the federal government coming in as a sort of attempt to occasionally to rectify this freedom to dominate others, and the local people fighting back with an anti-statist, racialized kind of conceptualization of freedom against the federal government that is trying to take away local people's freedom to dominate others.
Thank you. Your book includes several striking examples of white Americans who displaced indigenous Americans and exacted racial inequality from Reconstruction onwards, yet could claim to be the victims of an oppressive federal government. Did these people that you've studied acknowledge any contradiction in their claim that to be free meant having the freedom to deprive others of their liberty?
There were very few. There was, first of all, well encapsulated a version of the first part of the book. For the most part, except for some actors on the federal level, local people were pretty committed to seeing their freedom, as so much was in the Jacksonian period, as the freedom to access land. And land and liberty were connected very deeply in the Jacksonian period. So there's a few people, but the great irony of that section is it's Andrew Jackson himself, the great Indian killer, who half-heartedly supported Native American claims on that land.
Yeah. You've called local resistance to the federal government at the times when locals perceive the federal government acting against them as a quote, racialized anti-statism. And yet one of the great ironies that you bring out in the first few sections is that you also include several examples of local white communities becoming reliant on the federal government to protect them, especially in the first section when you use the example of the war against the Creeks. It seems to me, reading the book, that this anti-statism is anti-state when the state doesn't live up to the expectations placed upon it by the white men of your study. So could you please tell us a bit more about this complicated relationship that you've extrapolated?
No, that's exactly right. So the government, the federal government, the state government, local government, traditionally have and are supposed to, in white people's eyes, do their bidding. That's their job. The friction within the compound republic happens when they take the sides of other people or other interests. And that's when the fireworks begin to fly. And we see this battle over who gets to claim what. And this sense of betrayal. So this term racialized anti-statism, which is a little complicated, maybe a little too simple, really flares up when the state betrays the interests of white people, or is perceived, you know. And so, because it's gone back on its word. I mean, Jackson was elected to pursue land for white people in the South. He won every county in Alabama. When he goes in and he sends federal marshals and federal troops to kick white people out of Native American land, reversing his mission as a president, he loses the faith very, very quickly of local white people. So you have to use that phrase, racialized anti-statism, a little advisedly, because then it gets even more complicated to fast forward to today, when actually some of these people are actually capturing the state, the federal government, and then we have a problem of the dog catching the car that it's been sort of chasing.
Yeah, I would really love you to tell us a little bit more about Andrew Jackson, because he looms so large in the first section of your book, and yet, as you say, the analysis you present kind of cuts against a lot of what we maybe learn about Andrew Jackson at kind of undergrad level of, you know, Jacksonian democracy, expansion of white male claims on land and labor. And for the settlers that you're looking at, Andrew Jackson goes from being their guy that they invest all their hopes in to becoming, in a way, the symbol of everything that they're resisting against. And so the Andrew Jackson that they're fighting back is not the Andrew Jackson as he was, and you know, they see him as someone trying to stop white settlement into these lands. That's not really what he's about, and yet it becomes, in the way they present him, as a sort of symbol of everything wrong with the federal government. So, yeah, could you please tell our listeners a little bit more about the complicated relationship between Andrew Jackson and white freedom?
There's so many layers to that question. I was not a specialist on the 19th century. Maybe I'm still not, having spent most of my time on post-war U.S. So this was a fascinating sort of discovery. And there's a lot of points I'd like to make about that. The first one is Jackson's a little off the hook, because he becomes the central symbol for many people today, for Indian removal and all that. But we have to actually look at the popular reactions on the ground to Jackson, which in many ways were as bad or more extreme in their lust for land than even Jackson, which is a sort of politically challenging and humbling and scary conceptualization, right? So that's kind of the first thing that... Because Jackson's trying to put some bumpers, some restraints on this thing, and he just can't because of the voracious nature of land fever. And then the second thing that happens is interesting, is under the name of this kind of Jacksonian land grab that mobilizes commoners, or roughs as they were called at the time. The people who actually win are the elites. It's the speculators who actually get the upper hand on that. So, and even though they're doing it in the name of kind of the people, the white people. And this actually happens again during the Jim Crow Constitution era as well. So this kind of functioning of a Jeffersonian, Jacksonian politics of the people actually serving oligarchic kinds of interests is another kind of element there. And another thing I'd point out is there's this a recurring character throughout the book in different formations of people who kind of seem to be of goodwill but are really kind of pretty quick to sell out. And that and in this case, it's Andrew Jackson's pal, Francis Scott Key, the author of The Star-Spangled Banner, who kind of goes in there to fix it all up and ends up selling out the whole project to the white people and forcing the Creeks into a massive guerrilla war that they will not win.
Great. So we're just checking our script here. I wanted to ask you if you could elaborate a little bit more about the other side of the story you're telling. Those who come to rely on the federal government, despite the federal government's either inability or unwillingness to defend them, the Creeks, African Americans during Reconstruction. The federal government, in your analysis, comes to both symbolize an alternative path for those who fall outside of the white freedom paradigm, but also, in many cases, is the ultimate betrayer of those who come to rely on it, in that it is unable or unwilling to protect them. The key example you use of this is the violence that took place in Alabama around the 1874 election and the beginnings of the Redeemer government thereafter. So please could you tell our listeners about this moment and how the memory and legacy of this event gets taken over by the white community in Alabama to retroactively justify the receding of black civil rights?
Yeah, to your first point, this whole idea of the kind of federal government as the hero of the book, in a way, it's a terrible hero to have, right? The federal government's this kind of wishy-washy, weak-kneed, lousy protagonist. But both Native Americans and freedmen, and later and well into the 20th century, others understand that their only hope against the freedom of whites on the ground is the federal government. So if you think about that compound republic going from local to state to federal, black people and Native Americans wanted to push their citizenship up to the federal level. White people wanted to keep it down on the local level where they could control it. And that's really kind of the story here, is a federal vision of citizenship versus a local version of citizenship. And on a local one, it's where white freedom and violence can reign. A federal is, however ineffective it proves in the long run, is their hope. So, you know, to see these Muscogee Creek people writing Andrew Jackson saying, "You're our protector, you're our great hope, you're our savior, you've got to send troops," it's almost mind-boggling to think about it today. And I think the great example that you've already pointed out is the 1874 so-called Reconstruction Riot. And this comes after, once radical Reconstruction begins, it works. It works really well to have federal bayonets backing up a biracial democracy. And that is essentially how I see it, that it worked, that voting worked, that the only time a black congressman was sent to Washington, D.C. in the entire history of that area of Alabama was between 1872 and 1874. It hasn't happened, didn't happen before, and it hasn't happened since. And that's because there are federal troops on the ground to make sure the vote worked. It's a majority, that county is majority black after slaves were freed, moved in and then freed. So, there's black assemblymen state representatives going to the state assembly. There's black people in juries. It's working pretty well. And then white people try all sorts of political shenanigans to try and get rid of them by backing the liberal Republicans and all sorts of things. It ultimately doesn't work. And then in November of 1874, they decide to take matters into their own hands, as was happening in a lot of places in the South. And once black voters march en masse from the North and from the South to come in to vote in downtown Eufaula, which is the biggest town in Barber County, guns suddenly appear from the windows and from the porches and from everything, and they hail of bullets flies, and at least 80 people were shot right in front of the polling place in downtown Eufaula. And that was the end of Reconstruction in Barber County, because black Republicans either went silent or, if they were particularly active in public, ran for their lives out of the county. And if you drive into Eufaula today, you'll see a sign marking the Reconstruction Riot, And to your question about memory, it wasn't a riot. It was A, a massacre, and B, a coup d'etat. And it's hard for Americans to think about their country being run by such things as coups. But in fact, that's what happened throughout the Deep South in 1873, 74, and up through 76. Are these violent seizures of political power throughout the South? And what is basically called redemption of the white South is really, for the most part, I think, a violent overthrow of a democratic system.
Definitely, and I think you can see that even decades later at the Wilmington Race Riot as well in 1898. So it's definitely an unfortunate trend that continues onward. Pivoting towards post-Reconstruction, you called what followed the end of Reconstruction the neo-slavery of convict leasing, the vigilante justice of lynching, the degradation and debt of sharecropping, and the official disenfranchisement of African Americans under Jim Crow. Could you elaborate to our listeners exactly what convict leasing was and explain the legacies of this phenomenon into the 20th century?
Right. So all of those things you just mentioned are in this section I call federal power in repose, which is, this is the period in which the federal government is no longer a threat. It's pulling back. And in it, in the wake of it pulling back after 1877 and beyond, is some of the most heinous aspects of race relations in American history after slavery, and some, I would argue, were worse than slavery. Convict leasing was a terrible system in which, let me back up a little bit. There were no mines in Barber County. This is an agricultural area. But one of the biggest planters there, a guy named J.W. Comer, came up with the idea that he could run around and buy up contracts from all the convicts in all the counties and then send those convicts to the mines outside of Birmingham, which is a major coal mining region. And so basically these guys, the mining operators, got very cheap labor that was easily controllable and were completely disposable. So say, even unlike slavery, there was they weren't even invested in these guys living, because they could just go round up some more people and throw them in jail and then throw them into the mines. It also, the convict lease system also allowed for political control. If you got out of line, you're going to jail. It also helped fill the state coffers. They could run a prison system for free. So it was also a sort of proto-industrial move away from the agrarian tradition of the Old South. So it was kind of, you know, if you're really cynical, it was a pretty pretty good system for the state of Alabama.
Definitely. And then moving a bit more forward in time, to what extent do you see the federal government as unwilling to challenge local Southern power in the early 20th century? Is the federal level buying into this white freedom idea, or simply unable to challenge it?
Yeah, I think it's not even on the radar for the most part. The idea that the North poured all this energy into the war, poured all this energy into Reconstruction, certain sense of exhaustion, as well as massive problems in the North. This is the age of industrialization, industrial unrest, the massive strikes across the railroads and other industries provided a different preoccupation, and massive depressions throughout the Gilded Age. So despite all that, there's one sort of little beacon of hope in the 1890s, what's called the Lodge Force Bill, and named after Henry Cabot Lodge, which was essentially the Civil Rights Act, more or less, maybe even better than the one we got under Johnson, died because of a filibuster. And it's an amazing bill. So there is some energy there. It's not completely off the radar, but the Lodge Force Bill, and the word force is really interesting, right? That we're going to force people to behave. And I think it's actually an appropriate phrase in a lot of ways. So that was a hope. But when that didn't pass, what came in the wake were all the Jim Crow state constitutions that began in Mississippi and rolled throughout the South, and in Alabama in 1901 they passed this Jim Crow constitution that officially disenfranchised most black people.
And then moving back to George Wallace, would you be able to talk more about how he weaponized his anti-statist position in racial resentment in the 1960s?
Yeah, George Wallace is kind of the genius of this book, in a evil way, I think. So he starts out as a local politician in Barber County and a history nut, actually. He reads all the history he can of the local place. And so he knows all about the Creek Wars. He knows about Reconstruction. His father tells him the two worst things that ever happened were the Great Depression and Reconstruction, because both had stripped our Barber County of its economic might and political power. And so he's raised in that milieu, but he becomes sort of a New Deal populist kind of, not quite populist, but he wants to build roads and schools and hospitals and things like that. And he's not a real race baiter. And then he gets defeated. He eventually runs for governor in the 50s, gets defeated by somebody who's just race baiting throughout the campaign, and finally says, in very nasty terms, I won't be outraced again in American politics. And he goes pretty hard on the race question. But what he does, which is pretty smart, if you want to win races, is we often forget about the 1957 Civil Rights Act. And at that point, the Department of Justice was allowed to use the Civil Rights Act to go in and look at ballots and balloting. So the Department of Justice demanded the ballots for Barber County and the two surrounding counties because they were convinced that they weren't running fair elections. And George Wallace was judge of that area. And he refused to give the ballots up to the federal government. And he eventually did, but he made a huge show out of it, a total circus. And he got the reputation as what was known, what he called the fighting judge. And he actually runs for governor next as the fighting judge, because he's fighting the federal government, who's coming in to take your freedoms, to run your elections how you want to run them. And he takes this all the way to the governor's mansion. And that he loses, but that's part of his formula, too. George Wallace loses every time when he goes up against the federal government. But he wins the politics, right? Because he's able to use this as a constant churn to get people behind him, get them excited about fighting the federal government. And if you're fighting the federal government, freedom from the federal government, now you have a coalition. It's not just the racists. Now you're getting the racists. They're going to be in there, but now you can get business types. You can get people who are pissed off at the government, which are plenty of people, and you can get a much broader coalition, and that's pretty exciting. So in 1963, when he gives his famous inaugural address, which I open the book with, in which he says the famous words of his life, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, written by a Klansman, actually, for him. He mentions segregation a total of 4 times in the entire speech, those 3 one at a time. But he mentions freedom or liberty 24 times. And so to take George Wallace seriously, and I think we should, I don't think this is just window dressing, I think this is actually how freedom works in his mind, that he's a freedom fighter. He's fighting the federal government. He's protecting the people from the scourge of federal intervention. And that folds back into race, and then we're back to the earlier question about racialized anti-statism.
Thank you. It's difficult to read your book without seeing a lot of contemporary resonances. And so I wondered if you could tell us What resonances do you see for today, and what lessons might people learn from your book?
Yeah, the book got a review from George Packer saying it was fatalistic in The Atlantic, that it was very kind of dark and part of, say, the narrow confines of like the 1619 Project or something like that, that sees a kind of American DNA that can't be escaped on race. I see it very differently. I think there are lessons. And I think the lessons are really important. And the main one is that federal citizenship is really the central message. That voting rights, citizenship rights need to be protected on the federal level. That local white freedom is hostile to democracy. And that we need to move the entire discussion away from questions of freedom, which includes the freedom sort of to secede from the polity, and push it back towards democracy, which democracy requires the building of institutions. Democracy requires compromise. Democracy requires coming together in the civic space, which is very different than freedom, which is your ability to escape all that if you want to, or to dominate it if you want to. And in terms of contemporary lessons, the moment in the research where the scales sort of fell from my eyes on all this was while Wallace was kind of running the state government, SNCC and SCLC, so the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference were organizing on the ground after the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And, they're making it happen to try and get voters out. And this is happening in counties all over the Deep South. Well, Hosea Williams, who is King's key lieutenant, in fact, King nicknames him Castro because he can get stuff done in a way other people can't, is looking at the numbers of registration county by county. And he can't figure out why some counties are doing really well, other counties aren't doing. But he's like, well, it's not whether SELC or SNCC or Coalition are working. It's not whether they have charismatic leadership. It's not whether they have a good movement. What's going on? And finally figures out there's one factor that explains everything, and that one factor about how many people were registered to vote is whether there was a federal registrar on the ground in the county. And if there's a federal presence to ensure voting rights, it worked. If they weren't there, it did not work, no matter what the vision of the local activists may have been. And so that's a long-winded way of saying that's my take home.
Definitely. Thank you so much for answering these questions. We're going to move on to our quick fire round. We just have, we have about five just sort of short questions.
Okay, I'll try to be quick.
Okay. So the first one is, what's next for your research?
Oh!
It gets lighter, I promise.
Yeah, you said quick. I have like four or five different books I'm working on in different ways. I'm not quite sure what's going to be take root, but I have a sort of mythopoetic writerly project I'm doing on American history. We'll see whether that takes off. But I'm also interested in doing a kind of sort of metaphysical club of the New Deal, that book, The Metaphysical Club, for kind of New Deal activists. Probably that, but I'm still basking in the afterglow of this book.
Definitely.
Okay, question two. Who was your most inspirational teacher when you were a grad student?
Oh, boy. Well, I have an extended dedication to Leon Litwack, who was one of my instructors as an undergraduate. So that was really, really important to me because I began to think about this. But in grad school for this, I took an Old South class that I hadn't really thought about in a really long time. And I went back, and that class was run by Harry Watson. And I went back and I looked at this book by Mills Thornton called Power and Politics in a Slave Society, and it was about Alabama. And this is 30 years ago, and I'd circled every reference to freedom and individualism and everything else in that book. So I was already thinking about that in grad school. But I should say, my most single influential person was my advisor, Leanne Fink, as well as Jacqueline Hall.
And my next question is, leads exactly on from that, which is, which book slash historian has been the most influential and useful in writing this book?
Well, besides Orlando Patterson, on whose ideas I depend, I see this as an extension of Edmund S. Morgan's American Slavery, American Freedom.
And what advice do you have for PhD students who want to improve their writing?
Oh, I like that question. We may need a whole podcast on that.
We could use it.
I have a lot. You know, my tips would be, one, when you're opening a chapter, see the picture in your mind. And sort of have an idea of a scene. I almost write cinematographically in that way. But then don't bury it in this haze of baloney. Keep it up. Don't, you know, because what we tend to do is write the cute story and then dive into our analysis. Keep the narrative flowing. Two, short sentences. Y'all write too long of a sentence.
Oh, yeah.
So quit it. Every one of those you can break up. And if you can't say something complicated in a simple way, you don't understand it. And you can't expect your reader to understand it. So, and I would also say short chapters. I like short chapters, short sentences. The simple declarative sentence is your friend. And so know when to end a nice sentence.
So we're going to end with our light questions. So I saw that you did your PhD in North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And now you're currently at Vanderbilt. Between North Carolina and Tennessee, which do you think has the best barbecue?
Ye old barbecue question. Well, yes, the wrong guy. I'm a vegetarian.
We did think about this as a possibility, but
however, when I did eat meat, I did not like Carolina barbecue. I don't like that vinegary stuff. I'm gonna throw the question and say Texas. Texas brisket.
Texas does have good barbecue. I'm from North Carolina. Oh, okay. But thank you so
Where?
Much for from Durham.
Oh, okay.
So right and I worked at a barbecue restaurant after undergrad.
Oh,
summer,
I see.
So.
Yeah.
But I'm not a huge fan of the vinegar either.
Yeah.
It has to have coleslaw on it to kind of balance it out. Otherwise, it's not for me.
Yeah.
Hope we don't offend any vinegar fans out there on the podcast. But thank you so much for joining us, Professor Cowie. And we look forward to the discussion later.
It was a good time. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.